morning, Mr. Schultz.
Good morning, Counsel. Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Arthur Schultz. I represent the chaplain appellants, and I reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. This is a simple case. These chaplains asked the Court to order the Navy to establish the same promotion procedures for its chaplains corps that the Army and Air Force used to protect their officers from the personal prejudice, the Navy's own investigations document, and the denominational bias that appellants' evidence suggests, as well as the Navy's own investigation suggests. The Navy uses unique promotion procedures that are unlike the Army and Air Force, that shroud its promotion decisions in secrecy. The Navy's investigations show that these procedures facilitate and allow forbidden considerations to enter into the promotion process. The Navy allows one board member to secretly torpedo a chaplain's promotion opportunity, as well as his career in the Navy's upper-out system, a fact the Navy's own investigations document. Specifically, the Army and the Air Force use large boards and require a majority of the vote openly arrived at to reach promotion decisions, but not the Navy.
All right, can I just focus on a couple of things here since your time is limited? The district court ruled you lack standing.
Your Honor, it based that decision and said we couldn't somehow show that the chaplains would be prejudiced by future boards. That's contrary to every standing decision, Gratz v. Bollinger, even Emory versus the Secretary. This case, which was a racial discrimination, these chaplains are affected by these procedures, which allow essentially one person to dictate the results of the whole promotion board. They are directly affected, and the court can remedy that prejudice. The case is very clear that any religious influence in a promotion decision is forbidden by the Establishment Clause. And we're alleging that the procedures allow the fusion of religious and civic authority.
So the error was in applying a presumption of regularity?
Your Honor, that underlies everything that we believe, that everything that the district court addressed. Yes, that presumption was arrived at in a motion to dismiss in 2002. You see it, he says essentially, well, let me put it in my way. If these are regular, you can't show any prejudice. He's saying that you have to presume that the boards are proper. Well, if that happens, then how do you challenge any procedure done by a government official?
So among the plaintiffs are some persons who would appear before these promotion boards.
That's correct, Your Honor. We identify them specifically in the category.
And the district court was required to take your pleadings as true.
Yes, Your Honor, he was. Yes, Your Honor, and it's not just their pleadings. Everything we have is supported by evidence. Mm-hmm. See, another difference we see is that the promotion, the Army and Air Force require large boards. The Navy allows one board member to essentially dictate.
All right. But let's deal just here so I'm clear with the government's argument. The government says that in connection with seeking this preliminary injunction, what you're focusing on is future proceedings before these boards. All right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And I'm going to ask the government about this, and then it says the district court could properly rely on evidence outside the record, citing Land v. Dollar. And so this is pure speculation, says the government, as to what might happen at these future boards, and therefore the district court properly ruled that you lack standing.
Your Honor, I think if you apply that to any civil rights issue or racial classification or anything like that, you'd essentially keep them out. Well,
in NV versus District of Columbia, which the briefs cite, that was a civil rights case, and that required more than evidence of past discrimination in order to get an injunction. That was the point of that case, right? And that was a civil rights case.
Correct, Your Honor, but the unrebutted evidence shows that there is denominational bias in almost every aspect of the chaplain's decisions. For instance, the fact that the chief of chaplains are allowed to be president, the evidence shows a correlation.
Excuse me, but I don't think it's unrebutted. The government has an expert who reaches a different conclusion.
Your Honor, if you'll ask Mr. Yellen, he has admitted that their expert did not address denominational preferences. There is no Navy expert declaration after 2006. In 2006, the appellants focused on differences in the way the Navy treats denominations. There is nothing in the record. Now, the evidence about the chief of chaplains, that's a matter of counting up. There's nothing in the record that says that the expert miscounted, miscommunicated, or miscalculated, or used the used anything. The record is absent.
But I thought the Navy was saying, despite the fact that you have statistics showing imbalance in these promotions, that you are comparing Catholics promoted to Catholics eligible versus non-liturgical promoted to non-liturgical eligible, and that the numbers are going to be larger. The fact that the numbers are larger for the Catholics doesn't show discrimination if there are 10 times the number of Catholic chaplains as there are non-liturgical. Am I right about that? That's what they're saying about your statistics.
Your Honor, I'm thinking Palmer versus Schultz, which dealt with the discrimination, I think, is in the Panama Canal. You said, this court said, you compare the protected category versus the non-protected category. In this case, our experts has compared Catholics with others, and the question is, are they treated at the rates the same, and or can the difference be attributed to just chance? Every case that we have which has a comparison shows it is not attributable to chance. Now, we can't prove causation. We're not claiming that every chaplain is entitled to promotion. What we are claiming is that if they're denied promotion is based on something which is in their record. Every other, the Army and the Air Force require each board member to evaluate the record personally, and there is a way to account for his vote, the board member's vote, and the results, but not the Navy. The Navy requires them to vote anonymously. So if you zero out a candidate, it's done without any responsibility, personal responsibility or accountability for any reason which the Navy's own investigations document. Additionally, as the other branches require each member to look at the vote and look at the total record. The Navy allows one person to brief. There's no record of the briefing, no record of what he said, no record of anything. The other branches do not allow the chief of chaplains or his deputy to enter into the promotion decisions. The Navy...
Let me ask you this. If, let's say, you have 100 Catholic chaplains and 10 of them are promoted, and you have 10 non-liturgical and one is promoted, you have an imbalance there, but it's an imbalance that is not discriminatory. Now, are you saying that because we can't, or we don't know, I don't know what, how they voted or why they voted, that we can presume, or that, I mean, I don't understand how you get around that, just that the numbers are different according to the defendants. How do you respond to that? Are different according to the defendants because there are more of one than the other, so that explains the imbalance. What is your answer to that?
Your Honor, the question is how many in each category are promoted. If you are measuring blacks versus whites or Hispanic, you would look at what percentages and how they relate.
Right.
If, for instance, let me
so
call
you
your...
You have 10% in each one in my hypothetical. 100 Catholics, 10 promoted. 10 non-liturgical, 1 promoted. That's
no problem if they're equal. Okay. Your Honor, I call your attention to this. I gave you all an exhibit of the data. Okay. At tab 2... is the faith group promotions. This chart came from the Center for Naval Analysis, which was hired by the Navy to examine its promotion systems. If you look at each category in here, you'll find the promotions for at each rank for non-liturgicals is at the bottom or below the Catholics and the Protestants. That's the Navy's data, and you will find nowhere in the record this is challenged. They make the same recommendation that we did, that the Navy adopt the procedures of the Army and the Air Force, which precluded the same kinds of suits that this court is dealing with. That same recommendation about adopting the Air Force and Army procedures was made by the Federal District Court in the Southern District of California. I provide that decision in Appendium A of the reply brief. And
well,
you'll find
what I want to understand, though, is since the only thing before us other than the government's motion to dismiss, as I understand it, is the denial of your request for a preliminary injunction. So, as I understand it, part of your argument as to the district court's evaluation of the likelihood of your success on the merits is that the district court never applied the proper legal doctrine. In other words, it relied on this presumption, it never made findings, and instead ignored basically what the Supreme Court has said in these Establishment Clause cases as to what the proper analysis is.
You're right, Your Honor. That's absolutely correct. I see my time is up. May I answer your question?
And so the government responds in part that, well, the district court made 3 findings of fact here that are sufficient to show that you would lose on this first factor. Do you have any response?
Yes, Your Honor. The Navy responded in their opposition. They admitted they did not address denominational preferences. That's in there.
Yeah.
And the proper standards, evidence suggesting, you look at the their own investigations, there's all kinds of evidence suggesting denominational preference. The question is evidence suggesting? Once you look at suggestion, they're supposed to apply strict scrutiny. Then the burden shifts. I would submit that, for instance, this, which is unrebutted, and it's the Navy's own data, suggests, if nothing else, that there is denominational preference.
Don't say that yet. As I read the district court's decision, he used this presumption of regularity in his standing analysis. Do you see any place where he used it on the evaluation of the preliminary injunction?
Your Honor, right off the top of my head, I cannot say that, except that he did say that we couldn't show, again, because the things were legal, we because the presumption essentially moved the board proceedings out of the realm of consideration that we could never show.
Well, okay. Maybe when you stand back up, you could, on rebuttal, you could show me where in his decision this played a role in on the merits, that is, the preliminary injunction. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Did you understand that, what Judge Tatel's asking?
Yes, Your Honor. I think he's asking me on when I come back here to see if I can address where the presumption of regularity was applied specifically to the injunction criteria.
Right.
And in fairness, that may have been an error in my question.
Your Honor, I did not understand.
Well, I asked you the question about the district court's analysis of the first prong.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I suggested presumption of regularity, and it may have been an error.
All right.
As distinct from your arguments that the district court failed to apply Establishment Clause doctrine.
I understood you're asking me that we are arguing that he failed to apply Establishment Clause doctrine. Yes, Your Honor, that's our argument.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Yellen.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Louis Yellen from the Department of Justice. With me at council table is Christopher Hall. Your Honors, let me, if I may, start with standing. The district court concluded that based on the claims that the plaintiffs have made, the court would have to entertain speculative assumptions, and in particular, the assumption that naval officers who have a statutory, regulatory, an instructional obligation to impartially adjudicate and make determinations concerning promotions would nevertheless vote in terms of their denomination and always vote to promote persons, chaplains, for consideration if they're in their denomination and against them if they're not.
I'm not sure that's their argument. As I read the plaintiff's basic argument here, it's that certain aspects of the way in which the Navy structures its promotion boards, that those procedures facilitate the possibility of discrimination. So they say, for example, appointing the chief of chaplains as the chair, having small boards, and having voting in secret. They're challenging these procedures, and their allegation is that these procedures facilitate discrimination. And for purposes of standing, don't we have to assume that's true? And those procedures aren't going to change, right? In other words, the Navy isn't going to stop using those procedures in the future. So for purposes of standing, that is, showing future injury, their claim is that these procedures are the source of that injury. And for purposes of standing, I think we have to assume that that's the case. Now, on the merits, the Navy may be able to show that that's wrong, in which case you'll win. But for standing purposes, why isn't that enough?
I have two responses, yeah. Judge Tatel. Uh-huh. The first response is, you're quite right. They identify these particular mm-hmm. aspects of the boards, mm-hmm. which they say lead to discrimination. But the reason that they say these aspects of the board lead to discrimination is because they have a theory that they have proposed that the chief of chaplains is always going to vote for a member of his own denomination, and similarly with the other chaplain on the board. You can't separate out the particular mechanisms that they identify as bases for discrimination.
That's true in any discrimination case against the federal government. You could always respond by saying government supervisors are officials and you can't assume that they'll violate their oath by taking race into account in a decision. That's true in any employment case.
Well, if I may speak to the second point, which I think dovetails with the first.
I was just responding to your first point. Before you go on to the second.
I think the second point is directly responsive to this question. Okay. Let me try it out, Your Honor, and
sure.
if it's not, I'll of course come back. The second point is that we're here on the denial of a motion for a preliminary
right.
injunction. This is not a motion to dismiss.
Correct.
This is not a motion for summary judgment.
Right.
And in this context, there's good reason for believing that mere allegations are not sufficient to establish standing. In Lujan, the Supreme Court said that each element of standing must be supported in the same way as any other matter on which a plaintiff bears the burden of proof. In seeking a preliminary injunction, of course, the burden of plaintiff's proof is not just to make allegations of wrongdoing. It's to establish by evidence sufficient to carry the burden under a preliminary injunction that...
No. You've moved on to the preliminary injunction. I'm talking about standing.
I'm talking about standing too, Your Honor.
Let's stick with standing.
Lujan said...
Because there are two different standards.
I understand, Your Honor,
standing,
but Lujan...
You need to show future harm to get an injunction.
Yes, Your Honor.
The allegation is that the future harm comes from these procedural aspects of the process, that at least for purposes of standing, we have to assume we're right. Now, when you get to the preliminary injunction, you may be absolutely right that there's no evidence that would support an injunction at this point. But I'm only asking about standing, and why is it that the threat of future harm doesn't come from the procedures that they've challenged?
And Judge Tatel, I believe that I am only responding about standing. Let me come at this a different way, if I may, to try and clarify. To establish standing at the summary judgment stage, it's not sufficient just to rest on mere allegations. That's because in Lujan, the Supreme Court said that a plaintiff's burden on standing matches the plaintiff's burden of proof at any stage in the litigation. And on that basis, at the summary judgment stage, a plaintiff can't simply rely on the allegations to establish that plaintiff's standing.
Okay, it doesn't. It offers statistics.
Right.
And furthermore, it cites cases, right, including cases by the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court itself has acknowledged the difficulty of somebody who is a religious figure acting either contrary to or without regard to. And isn't that enough for standing? Only standing.
Only standing, Your Honor, but you need more than allegations.
Okay, so
you need,
in your view of the law, who would have standing to bring a claim that these procedures violate the Establishment Clause?
If a plaintiff were able to come forward with evidence at the preliminary injunction stage showing, for example, that the composition of a chaplain corps promotion board contains an individual who has repeatedly discriminated and been reprimanded.
That's one way.
You asked an example.
I know, but I think what Judge Taylor and I are trying to understand is, since the district court has to take the allegations of the complaint as true, and they're challenging these three procedures, and some of the plaintiffs are the type of people who will go before these very boards which will be applying these procedures, what more can the plaintiff possibly show, unless first you have to have a trial on the merits before you can get any type of injunction?
Well, Your Honor, I'm challenging precisely the idea that you only have to assert your allegations to establish standing. You do, to get a preliminary injunction, have to provide evidence for the court, right?
Just think that the evidence they've provided isn't enough. And you want the smoking gun, where a chaplain who served on a board said, yes, you know, I'm biased in favor of Catholics serving.
It's not just that the evidence...
And absent that, there wouldn't be standing.
It's not just that the evidence isn't enough, Your Honor. It's that the evidence cannot even bear the implication that there would be discrimination. And this merges to some extent with the actual merits, and if I may turn to that, because...
No, wait, before you go to the merits, what about the their experts' statistics, which show that, at least for some periods of time, the promotion rates for non-liturgical chaplains were lower than the promotion rates for Catholics?
We're talking about their experts?
Yeah.
This is actually what I was going to pivot to, if I may, Your Honor. Their experts' analysis is infected throughout with very significant statistical flaws. First of all, their experts' analysis is...
This sounds like the merits to me.
Again, Your Honor, I think that to establish standing, you don't have to establish your full merits case. We completely concede that, but there has to be an evidentiary basis for your claims in order to establish that you are more likely than not to suffer imminent injury. And if there is...
Like you're applying a Rule 50 standard.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think you have to provide a basis in evidence to be able to have standing to obtain prospective injunctive relief. And if there is no basis in evidence, if the evidence that you've put forward utterly fails to establish any likelihood of future injury, you haven't established that you're going to suffer injury.
Well, here's their evidence, as I went over with you before, and you're saying it's not enough.
They
have people who are going before these boards. These boards are going to use procedures that they claim are likely to result in discrimination on the basis of religion, and they have statistics that show that, in fact, the particular religious order that they are focusing on is very seldom appointed. Now, the Navy may have a ton of good reasons, but we're just at standing. Well, and your point is that absent, you know, a chaplain confessing that he served on a board and he did discriminate, that you can't even have standing.
I'm not suggesting that, Your Honor.
Why don't you give an example other than a member of the board who has admitted you know, pro-Roman Catholic or something?
I don't have an example off the top of my head. If I may, Judge Henderson, let me go about it the other way. Let's hypothetically assume that it is patent on the face of the plaintiff's statistical analysis that they have not established any difference in treatment whatsoever, none whatsoever. They say that it does, but if you look at it, it's just as obvious as 1 + 1 = 2. There is no evidence of discrimination. That would be insufficient to establish injury to carry a preliminary injunction motion for standing purposes. Now, it's not obvious in the 1 + 1 = 2 sense. I grant you that. We're dealing with statistical analysis. But a judge, in determining whether or not a plaintiff has shown that it is more likely than not that they're going to suffer imminent injury, can look at the evidence in the record that's being submitted and make a determination. And I think that here, there was very compelling reasons to think that plaintiffs have not established any basis for showing that they are likely to suffer imminent future injury.
How about this faith group promotions chart?
This faith group promotions chart, Your Honor, a couple of things about it that plaintiffs have not, I think, adequately explained. First of all, this comes from a Center for Naval Analysis study that involved data between 1977 and 1999. It ended in 1999. The data showed that the analysis showed that looking at the data in the complete aggregate, there was a meaningful difference in the promotion rate of Catholics for one rank above others. However, the very same study showed that the differences disappeared when the sample was restricted to post-1986. So this very study on which plaintiffs have relied showed that after 1986, there is zero statistically significant difference in the promotion rates of individuals.
All right. They say this is from 72 to present on this actual chart. Are you challenging?
Yes, Your Honor, that is not accurate. This study appears as Exhibit 14 to plaintiff's motion for summary judgment filed in December 2008. The court may look at this, obviously, on its own. The data of that analysis was 1977 to 1999. Perhaps at the time, present means, I believe the study came out in 2000, so it may be that present in the slide meant 2000 just because the study went to 1999, but it certainly doesn't say anything post-1999, and as I said, page 1 of the study says explicitly that when we looked at the data from 1986 to the present, to 1999, there was no statistically significant difference in promotion rates.
Suppose you had a case like this one, but not this one, where you have competing experts on the critical question of whether there is discrimination. And one expert says there is, and he has data, and the other expert says there isn't. And we think it just can't be resolved on the basis of the competing affidavits. Then what?
Then no preliminary injunction.
No, we're talking about standing.
I'm sorry, I beg your pardon, Your Honor. I thought we had shifted.
No, we've been talking about standing here. If you want to talk about the preliminary injunction, I have a different set of questions for you. But on standing, under my case, the plaintiff wouldn't lose on standing, right?
Under those circumstances, I think that's right, Your
Honor. So under your theory, then, for us to conclude that this plaintiff lacks standing, we have to be able to essentially find, based on these competing experts, that there is, in fact, no record of denominational preference, right?
I think you would have to find that the district court correctly made that determination And it's in part a factual determination, so there would be some deference to district court fact-finding.
Well,
but
how could
I agree.
Possibly? Is this the district court finding? Plaintiffs have no evidence from which the court could assume that future boards, is that?
That's there, and there are a number of other places of, on 12.
You know, like, what's, give me another example.
It is no less succinct, but on 1287, the district court said that the plaintiff's evidence established as at best a colorable claim for relief under the Establishment Clause.
How can we review that? Is your point we review that for clear error?
Yes, Your Honor.
And how could we possibly review that?
Well, Your Honor, this court.
I have no idea what he meant.
This court in Alipio, 480 F3rd at 1159, deferred to a district court's implicit factual findings in granting a preliminary injunction. I think that here, I concede, Your Honor, this is not a detailed analysis of the facts.
Isn't a colorable case enough for standing?
That's as to, that quotation, Your Honor, was as to past discrimination.
Uh-huh.
The district court did not say that they made out a colorable case for future discrimination.
You know, let's go on and talk about the preliminary injunction. For
please,
that.
Your Honor.
Okay. The key finding on likely success on the merits was this. He gave two reasons. The key one really was plaintiff had no evidence, quote, this is the one I was just reading you, from which the court can assume that future boards will follow any pattern of discrimination, right?
Putative pattern of past discrimination. Yes, Your Honor.
That's his finding.
Yes, Your Honor.
On likelihood of success on the merits.
Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't that the wrong standard? That looks like the standard for standing, future.
Your Honor, to receive an injunction, you are necessarily enjoining future conduct because of an alleged harm. If you cannot show,
yeah, but if I have evidence that shows a pattern of discrimination, say it's a clear pattern. Let's assume that we're talking about a different case, not this one. And the plaintiff's evidence is very clear that there's been a pattern of discrimination. All right? Correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Let's assume it's really clear, and that there's irreparable injury. Are you telling me you can't get a preliminary injunction?
No, I'm not telling you that.
No, of course not.
Here in this case, Your Honor, the district court found that there was neither.
You don't look to the future for purposes of the preliminary injunction. You just ask whether or not plaintiff's likely to succeed on the merits, and if he's got a powerful case of past discrimination, he's likely to succeed on the merits. Here, for the purpose of the preliminary injunction, you have the judge looking to the future, which is the question we've been discussing about standing, but is the wrong question for purposes of likelihood of success on the merits for the preliminary injunction, isn't
it? I think that's not reading the district court's decision entirely, Your Honor. The
I read you every word.
And, Your Honor, on page 12.
From which the court could assume that future boards will follow. What has that got to do?
Based on a putative past discrimination. And the district court on page 1287 said, the court notes that the evidence put forth by the plaintiffs at best establishes a colorable claim to relief under the Establishment Clause. That's referring to past discrimination. The district court found that there wasn't sufficient evidence to establish the plaintiff's burden of likelihood of success on the merits, either as to present or past discrimination, Your Honor. And if the plaintiffs...
Part of the problem is, it seems to me, as Judge Tatel is exploring with you, is the district court, for example, said, well, the plaintiffs have an expert, the defendants have an expert. They conflict. And he never resolves how he views the evidence in terms of a substantial likelihood of success.
I think he did resolve it, Your Honor. It's implicit, agreed, Your Honor. But if the court looks at the Alipio case, which I cited, the court again affirmed a granting of a preliminary injunction, that's Alipio.
Yeah.
It's 480 F3rd 1159. Mm-hmm. The court deferred to an implicit factual finding by the district court in affirming the grant of a preliminary injunction. But if I may, Your Honor.
Is that a strong case?
I beg your pardon?
I don't remember it offhand.
The court is explicit that it's deferring to an implicit finding.
No, I know it's explicit as to that, but, you know, sometimes we say things where, you know, it's harmless error, so you don't have to go through everything.
I think it was necessary to the affirmance,
necessary
if that's what you're
finding.
Asking, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's my recollection.
So tell me once again how you explain this phrase, future boards, the use of the word future. Explain that to me once more.
I think, Your Honor, that the opinion as a whole shows that...
No, just this sentence. This is his finding. This is one of his two findings for denying, for ruling there's no likelihood of success on the merits.
Your Honor, I think it's unfair to cabin me to that provision when there's this other provision at the tail end of the opinion, which is referring back to the earlier standards. The district court found both that there was no insufficient evidence of either past or future discrimination. And I think, you know, if you're asking me if the district court had only found that there was no evidence of future discrimination but found lots of past discrimination, would the district court would have
and
been
what's
correct.
What's the other language you want me to rely on? You want me to look at it?
It's at 1287, Your Honor, and it's the court notes that the evidence put forth by the plaintiffs at best establishes a colorable claim to relief under the Establishment Clause. Absent a clearer showing of plaintiffs' likelihood of success on the merits, there is no justification for the court to deviate from the ordinary course of adjudication and judicial review.
How would you separate that from earlier? Read that again. Sentence before that.
I hadn't read the sentence before that.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said, as the court explained. What did it say?
In your brief, you cite three findings. The first two, he's talking about future promotions.
Yeah.
And then the third is the one Judge Tatel is focusing on. And the question is, given that you're saying he's made sufficient findings, and the first two all deal with future, and then he comes to this colorable claim, how do you know that the district court judge wasn't simply dealing with the same thing? He doesn't distinguish.
Your Honor, I think he's talking, Your Honor, he's talking about claims to relief under the Establishment Clause. He's not talking about a right to a preliminary injunction there. And plaintiffs, this is a judge who's been adjudicating this case for 11 years, and the plaintiffs' claims in the case are retrospective in addition to seeking prospective relief. The language is broader here, and he's not just talking about whether they will suffer injury in the future. So I think the most natural reading of that phrase is referring to the retrospective claims. If I may make two points that I really would like the court not to overlook. The first is, I think it's quite critical in evaluating the validity of the district court's denial of a motion for preliminary injunction, the fact that the plaintiffs have not in any place in either their opening or their reply brief challenged the district court's discretion in balancing the equities. There is no attempt whatsoever. So they have placed their flag entirely on their allegations of error on the merits determination and their allegations, or I should say arguments, that the district court erred in accepting the defendant's evidence concerning harm to third parties and harm to the public interest.
Well, let me ask you just back on this finding that Judge Tatel was asking you about. One of the questions is whether or not that's really a finding of fact as distinct from a conclusion of law. And where are the findings that are necessary to support that conclusion? And as I mentioned, you cite three findings, and you acknowledge the first two are all dealing with the future, and the third, absent some findings, seems to be a legal conclusion.
The colorable claim argument?
Yes.
It is a, I would say it's a mixed determination, Your Honor. I think because it is a question about whether or not the allegations support relief, anything more than a colorable claim under the Establishment Clause. So I would agree that it's not a pure factual question because there is an application or an inference of an application of a legal standard there. So I think that's right, but it is based in part on factual findings about alleged injury. The other point that I would like to make, Your Honor, is in evaluating whether or not the district court committed any sort of error in denying a plaintiff's motion for a preliminary injunction, I really urge the court to take a look at the defendant's expert's analysis, 114 to 144, and then any of the plaintiff's expert's analysis. And the reason why I think looking at those in juxtaposition is critical in this evaluation on the merits is the defendant's expert explains in clear detail that plaintiff's expert engages in two absolutely fundamental and obvious statistical errors in all of that expert's analysis. First, there's a moving target. The plaintiff's expert engages in post hoc analysis. The plaintiffs began this litigation 11 years ago by focusing on faith group clusters. When their analysis wasn't supported by the data, they switched their categories and now refer to something that they call denominational favoritism. And I want to make it very clear that this is, in plaintiff's use, a technical term. What they have done is they have carved out the non-liturgical Protestant categories like Baptists that have a favorable promotion rate so as to suppress the promotion rate of the
All
other.
Right. But let me just be so I understand what's happening here. The expert acknowledges that he's been in this case for a decade and that things have changed. And here's his latest analysis in light of, he says, data that has just been turned over to him. All right, so then he comes up with this analysis. I don't understand why that's necessarily a flawed approach.
The flaw is, Your Honor, if I say that you discriminate against all tall people, I don't mean to make it personal, that an entity discriminates against all tall people, and then it turns out that people who are 6 foot tall are not discriminated against in the least. And then if I come back to you and say, well, I'm going to take them out of the analysis, and now we're just going to look at people over 6 foot five.
So my case isn't going to be as gigantic as I originally thought. It's going to be a lot narrower.
Okay. But, Your Honor, the problem is that the plaintiffs mix and match their results. They use some of the data that applies to 6 foot tall people and some of the data that applies to 6 foot five tall people, and they mix it and match it as their is useful for their analysis. And this gets to the second problem, one which Judge Henderson alluded to in questioning of opposing counsel. The plaintiff's expert engages in apples to oranges analysis throughout. So, for example, the plaintiff's expert routinely compares the number of promotion by faith groups without considering the number of applicants in a faith group for a promotion.
Why shouldn't we send this back and let the district court make some findings?
Because, Your Honor, it's the plaintiff's burden on a preliminary injunction to show a clear entitlement. If Your Honors think that it's a close case and that the district court provided an insufficient factual basis for this court to evaluate, then perhaps that would be an advisable course. But I have to say, Your Honor, given the plaintiff's burden, given this record, and given the very obvious statistical errors that were made here, and in addition, given the legal theories that the plaintiffs are asking this court to adopt, we're not in that range, and a remand would not be appropriate.
But acknowledge in your brief that the district court's reference to a legal theory, we have no idea what he was talking about.
No, Your Honor, but that's a de novo question, and we've given the court reasons for thinking that the district court was entirely proper. And
he's clearly wrong about that, isn't he? I mean, if there's evidence that there's denominational discrimination, that's a theory on which the plaintiffs could proceed.
That's not the legal error. That's not what we're defending, Judge Tatel. Uh-huh. We're defending the idea that if there is not evidence of denominational favoritism,
okay,
that the burden is nevertheless on the government to show that its conduct satisfies strict scrutiny, which is something that
I didn't understand the plaintiffs were making that argument. But let me go back just so I completely understand the government's position.
Yes, Your Honor.
You're telling us that your position is, look, you can look at these affidavits and this evidence, and you can just see, right, that there's no evidence of denominational preference because of statistical errors and selection and other things that flaws in the expert, right?
That the plaintiffs have failed to establish,
now,
yes.
Are you asking us to look at that ourselves, or is there a district court finding on that that we're reviewing?
Your Honor, there is a district court finding, as I've agreed many times, right. It's an implicit finding.
Okay. And we're reviewing that for clear error, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, fine. Yes. Okay, fine. That's it. Thank you.
All right. You agree there is no finding that goes into any of the discussion you and Judge Tatel have just been having.
There's no
statistical error.
There's no explicit finding, Your Honor. It's either an implicit finding.
He says we have two experts. They disagree. That's what we know the district court thinks.
No, but Your Honor, the district court also said that the plaintiffs have given no evidence from which the court may assume. That's looking at the evidence. It's not.
But you know, there is a difference between saying two people disagree and whether or not there's enough under the first factor.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And
I agree that there is
making the district court make these findings so we can review, as opposed to us sitting as a district court going through this material and making the findings.
Yes, Judge Rogers, and let me be clear. There is language such as you're referring to suggesting that there is conflicting evidence, but there is in addition language that shows that the district court looked at the evidence and came to a conclusion, as such as when the district court said there's no evidence from which I can make an inference of.
But he never told us why.
I agree, and that's not ideal.
The rule requires him to make findings.
Not in denying a motion. The rule requires a finding if there's a grant of a preliminary injunction.
So your brief's emphasis on the findings the district court made are virtually gratuitous here?
No, not at all, Your Honor,
right.
Because the question is whether there was whether the district court erred. My only point,
and
Your Honor, was that the rule.
All my question is trying to get at is the district court may have reached the right conclusion. Can we figure out why?
Right, Your Honor. And the question is whether.
And I thought your brief was trying to explain, based on the record, that there were sufficient findings that we could conclude he was correct.
That's exactly right. And I didn't mean to suggest that a district court, you know, that there are no rules applicable or that there are no evidentiary requirements. I was just responding to the specific point about the rule. If I may make one sentence, one last sentence, which is the reliance on the IG reports that plaintiff relies on, since it's government's evidence. The IG reports identified specific instances of either discrimination or problems in a particular selection board. The IG reports explicitly, however, Your Honor, found that there was no evidence of systematic bias. And an example of that would be 2JA 549. That's the Defense Department report, which expressly said, we're making no recommendations for systematic change because we found the problem we found was inherent to this particular board and not a systematic problem.
What was the problem they found?
My recollection was that there were statements that were made that were considered to go over the line in terms of what was proper.
Right. Somebody confessed.
A particular person,
right.
Yes.
Yeah, so they had no occasion because they never looked at the systemic because they
No,
had
that's
the
not
smoking.
Correct, Your Honor.
Well, they said
the DOD report.
Excuse me, go ahead.
The DOD report did say that it looked beyond that and said, and you can look at the citation.
At these three procedures that are challenged?
I'm making a different point, Your Honor.
I understand what you're saying. I think I understand what you're saying, is that there was a look at this, and they said there's no systemic problem here.
That's right. And I'm using this only defensively, Your Honor, in response to plaintiff's reliance on the IG reports supposedly as evidence of discrimination. Thank you, Your Honors. If there are no – thank you.
And you just – so I'm just clear on this point. You're just saying that – they failed to show sort of a causative.
No, I'm saying the IG reports do not provide the evidence that the plaintiffs have claimed. The evidence the plaintiffs have relied.
I'm just thinking about the IG reports now.
Yes, the plaintiffs have relied on the IG reports to support their claim that the government's own evidence purportedly shows discrimination, widespread discrimination against chaplains of a particular faith. In fact, the IG reports found problems with particular boards and provided recommendations for corrections, such as the calling of a special selection board to allow the particular injured party to be reconsidered for promotion. But those very same reports concluded that there was no systematic problem here. So my only point here is that the plaintiff's reliance on the IG reports does not do what they claim that it does.
Let me ask you one last question.
Yes, ma'am, Your Honor.
And that is it your position that if we sent it back, your position being this implicit finding, that all the judge would do would be to set, to make explicit, when I said there is no evidence, what I meant was I looked at all the evidence, I weighed it, I found the government's more credible?
Yes, Your Honor, with one qualification. This had been before Judge Urbina, who's now retired. The case has been reassigned to Judge Kessler, and when it's before a new judge, if it went back down, I think it would be within her discretion to decide if she wants to do something further than that. Had it been before the exact same judge who was presiding, I think what you described is what we would expect to happen.
Wouldn't that also be inadequate? I mean, doesn't the district court need to explain, just the way you did here a few minutes ago, when you went through the two affidavits and showed us what the statistical flaws were in the plaintiff's evidence, that's the reason why he found that there was no sufficient evidence here? Doesn't he need to tell us that?
Judge Tatel, I will certainly agree with you that it would be much, much better for district courts to do that, mm-hmm. to be explicit. We would encourage that. We think that it's better for the court's review and better for the government's defense of a ruling in its favor, or even better in allowing the government to challenge a ruling that disagrees with. However, the question, I think, for your honors is whether that is a sufficient basis to reverse and remand a denial of a preliminary injunction where it is we suggest patent that the plaintiffs have not established their clear entitlement to review and have not established sufficient error in the court below.
Could I ask you one other question? And you may not know this, I realize. What's the status of the case before the district court at this point?
Since the case has been transferred to Judge Kessler, there is a new case management order that's been entered, which directs some streamlined briefing on a number of different merits. As Your Honor knows, this is a consolidation of three different cases. My understanding is that, and counsel for plaintiffs can obviously speak to this more directly than I, but my understanding is that there is this new order that is governing the future of the litigation here.
All right, thanks.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay. All right, Mr. Schultz, why don't you take 3 minutes, and we'll see if all the questions can be answered. If not,
thank you, Your Honor.
As long as we have them. Go ahead.
But I want to respond to Judge Tatel's question about where in the record. On page 11, he does not say specifically he relies on the presumption of regularity. He makes two statements that I think indicate that's where he was heading. One is he said there is no evidence that the court could assume, Then he also says, he talks about there is no theory that the Supreme Court recognized. If you go back to his original decision in the motion to dismiss, when he applied that presumption, he essentially said the Supreme Court instructs us not to do these things. And as I read that, based on what my experience with him, it seemed to me he was relying on the presumption of regularity. I hope I've answered your question, Your Honor. I need to hopefully address a couple of, I think, major errors in counsel's presentation. One is he said our theory is that a chaplain or the chief will always vote. That is not our theory. The theory is that they will vote sometimes consciously, but many times unconsciously. We're dealing here with promotion. A promotion is a reward for past performance. The performance here is ministry. Let me say it again, ministry, a religious exercise. And you're putting a religious person like the chief in charge of evaluating ministry. He comes at it from his own perspective. Chaplain Holderby in the 1997 board, which is testimony is documented, went above and admitted arguing for a chaplain of the same denomination because of a devotional he heard. I can't imagine what the devotional requirement is for a commander, but that's what he said. I'd like to get back to the CNA chart, which counsel says supports their theory. In red, at the bottom, it says results highlighted are statistically different from the overall sample. In Palmer versus Schultz, this court explains that the comparison is between protected classes and non-protected. You don't compare one class with the average because that hides discrimination. What this is saying is that even when you look at it for wrong standard, these people, the Catholics here, are way out of bounds. When you go back and analyze it by category, this actually shows, as our expert has done, that there is prejudice. Following that is a series.
Before you get off of this, what does present mean there? When it says
Your Honor, they briefed this in 2000 in February, so I assume it's up to 1999, which would cover the fiscal year 2000 board. But it does say 1972, and I believe my expert would say that's perhaps right. It's 1972.
To the present,
at this time, it was 2000. February 2000 was when this chart was briefed to the Navy leadership. Okay. Following the CNA made some comment about the above zone promotions hadn't played out. We went back and looked at the above zone promotions. That follows us. This is an example that again remains unchallenged. We've gone through each of these boards from 1981 through, because that's the only data we had, and we tracked the above zone promotions. And you will see on the first page after that, there's statistically significant differences in above zone promotion rates. So the data does not support them. I want to again refer you to page 23 of our opening brief. We quote there the expert because he says, plaintiffs are correct. This is responding to the motion to dismiss. I clearly state in my report I was specifically asked to determine if non-liturgical chaplains were more likely than liturgical chaplains to be selected. He's agreeing that he did not examine denominational issues. Now, to address the issue about somehow the field has shifted, on tab one is a analysis. As Judge Rogers correctly pointed out, we start out with broad allegations of what's happening here. As you go through, you develop evidence and you sharpen it. Our underlying theory has always been that there is prejudice against our group. Okay. If you look at this, this records the number of board appearances by chaplains on the board. And it falls into four tiers. Just by the percentages and the number of appearances. Each of those tiers, when you examine it by denominations, you find a statistically significant promotion rate for each tier. That evidence is not challenged anywhere in this document, anywhere in the record, and I challenge the council to prove me wrong. We're saying that this is evidence. There is Dr. Siska and their experts has no report following 2006. There's nothing that criticizes or shows where any error was a mistake. If you look at tab three, he said we didn't consider applicants. Number of considers, number of selections, 33% at commander if you had a match as chief of chaplains. And the same for captains. Those numbers, as I said, it's a matter of counting. There's nothing here near to show the count is wrong or the computations are wrong. I want to point out again that this court in Chaplain Cecil Gospel Churches 454 F3rd said that the interest involved here is protection from establishment. When there's an invasion of that interest, that provides the concrete injury necessary to sustain standing. Council also talked about the Naval Inspector General's investigations. In the 2000 captains involved Washburn, she said she had seen numerous cases where this zeroing process had been applied. Admiral Black admitted, he described it. He talked about how it was a practice. And so for the Navy to say, oh, gee, there's nothing systematic here, the evidence that they had before them shows it's wrong. Plus, you have four investigations all showing problems. None of the other services have this, which gets back to my point. We're looking for procedures that the Army and the Air Force use which preclude that provide transparency and fair, fundamental fairness to every chaplain. Well, Your Honor, I do want to emphasize that, well, Your Honor, have I answered your questions, or are there other questions that I can answer?
I think so. If there's nothing further, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, if I can just conclude, we believe that the district court denied our applicants the same fundamental fairness and equal protection of the law that are granted to the Army and the Air Force officers. And so we think that is an abuse of discretion. I thank you for your consideration.
Can I just ask you, on the status of matters before the district court, there is this case management order?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there a trial date set?
No, Your Honor. There are three things to take us out through the next summer. Judge Kessler wants a consolidated complaint. She wants all of the allegations in the three complaints. The Navy has some issues that they want to raise about statute of limitations, and there are, can't think of.
That's all right. Tells me what I need to know. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. But she's.
Thank you.